the most significant example of luck changing events, changing history?
So, David, I suspect... Well, first of all, thank you for agreeing to moderate this event this evening. David is somebody who, of course, is a deeply thoughtful writer in his own right. Indeed, his biography of Sir Garfield Barwick was cited as recently as today, I understand, by Dyson Hayden.
He didn't name me. He just said I was not of a right-wing persuasion.
So David's thoughtfulness and humour is much just an honour to me to have him doing the event and to have all of you here tonight. This is a spot familiar to me as well. I remember the time when there had been a bomb threat in one of my law exams, and they had to call it off. And they brought us to McLaurin Hall in order to then disperse us to secret locations across the campus after we'd left all our mobile phones here, so the bomb threat couldn't happen again. So it has all kinds of troubling associations for each of us. And it's pleasing. I always feel a little bit pleased when I come in here and I see the jacaranda tree is not flowering, because I always just get a little bit nervous when the jacaranda tree is flowering, albeit that it's well past the time where I need to worry about studying for exams.
You know that it's sick.
Oh, dear.
The jacaranda tree is sick, yes. Fortunes are being spent trying to keep it alive.
We've made clones of it from the seedlings from it, so that there's not a kind of existential identity crisis in the university.
Otherwise, all studying can stop. So, David, to get to your...
Could I also point out one other thing about the McLaren Hall, and Anthony Green has already pointed it out. There are a number of judges on it around these walls, and they were all, without exception, hanging judges and bastards. Anyway, but that's what Sydney University was very good at. Right, now, my question,
yes.
Andrew. The chance event that has had the greatest impact in history.
So you'd have to think the start of World War One, at least the timing of the start of World War One, has got to be important. I feel a little guilty here, David. It was you that wrote this up for the Saturday paper so beautifully. But that moment in which the car carrying Franz Ferdinand thinks they've gotten away from the assassination team, takes a wrong turn down a laneway. It's a narrow laneway, and Gavrilo Princip is just waiting there, takes the shot, and the car has nowhere to go. That's the pretext that Austria needs for war with Serbia, and World War One follows. And of course, the many, many millions who were killed through that conflict.
I'm always glad to have my own work cited in public, but I was actually going for the storm that hit the Armada. The Armada has sailed for England. It is an enormous fleet of ships. It is full of troops. England is completely vulnerable to invasion. They are, amongst other things, all playing bowls at the time. And a storm hits.
A storm hits. The Armada is largely dashed against the rocks, and the Spanish invasion of Britain doesn't ensue. Sailing produces all kinds of interesting, lucky events. There's a moment when Cook is travelling north when his ship strikes the coral, and they immediately begin to think that they're going to have to abandon the ship, when it turns out that the piece of coral they've hit has lodged in the hull. It's sort of acted as its own plug. And they manage to hold the ship together for long enough that they're able to patch it up and keep the ship. About 10 years later, La Perouse is sailing around the coast where he strikes a coral reef. The ship is destroyed and everyone on board is killed. If those two accidents had been reversed, we might be carrying out this conversation in French rather than English this evening.
And the memorial of Cook's problems, of course, are the spectacularly beautiful place names he gives that coast of Queensland, Cape Tribulation, because he writes, this is the point at which all our tribulations began. Now, look, what about Australian bad luck? Okay, the really important moments of chance in the development of Australia, particularly politically.
So, I mean, you've first got to think about the economic moments. So there's a couple of moments in which Australian economic history could have been very different. When gold is discovered...
That's pure luck.
The finding of gold is absolutely luck. But then the selection of the claim size is lucky too. Big claim sizes mean a small number of very rich people have a number of wage slaves doing the mining for them. That's the story of mining in Sierra Leone, largely through Latin America. But we pick this tiny little claim size, 8 foot by 8 foot. You can just imagine it there on the floor in front of us. And that means that the luck of gold is dispersed in a surprisingly democratic way. And that, of course, has huge implications for the polity, because then you don't have this rampant inequality that comes from a mining elite with a set of wage slaves. Then there's this other moment on which there's the decision as to whether to allow the squatocracy to take over, whether Australia should have one person, one vote, or whether the amount of land that you have should determine your political influence. And it's Britain who insists that we have to have this democratic compact, which stopped the squatters from claiming power. And then later on, there's a decision not to let the north of Queensland be its own state, which would have probably been a sort of antebellum state with Kanakas brought in, and again, might have been a much more unequal place, not befitting the sort of egalitarian values. So that's all 19th century luck, which we now take so much for granted, but which has really shaped who we are as a nation.
Before we get out of the 19th century, do you know about the Cooley question?
A little, but I'm sure you know something I don't.
No, it's just that this is something I knew nothing about until very recently, and I've written something perhaps a little pompously and a little overconfidently, that Australia only began to be worried about imported races at the time of the gold rushes. Not at all. In the 1830s, when there was a wool boom going on and there wasn't enough labour and we didn't have enough convicts, the rich in the colony wanted to bring coolies down from Bengal. They wanted to introduce coloured labour into Australia in the same way that was going over to South Africa. And again, London said no. The wisdom of London in the first 30 or 40 years of the colony was astonishing. Anyway, 19th century. That's about 19th century. 20th century. I'm going to ask you about Bertie Milliner's heart attack.
Yes. So Bertie Milliner is a Labor senator from Queensland who has a heart attack at exactly the wrong moment from the point of view of the Whitlam government.
Let alone from his own point of view.
From his own point of view.
Put that to one side.
Yeah. But, I mean, as you know, heart attacks come from a build-up of plaque in the artery wall, and then at a certain moment, a little bit of it breaks free and lodges. That build-up process takes decades, and the actual moment at which the plaque breaks free and causes the heart attack is surely, from your own perspective, and even more so from everyone else's perspective, luck. Had it happened in 1976, it would have had no impact. But happening as it did in 1974, I'm pretty sure, it then destabilises the Whitlam government. Joe Bjelke-Petersen, of whom we can say more about his luck later on, chooses to replace Milliner not with the preferred candidate, who, as we know, is Mal Colston, is Labor's preferred candidate at that time, but with candidates who the Labor Party consider less loyal. That splits the numbers in the Senate and makes it possible for the Senate to block supply. A heart attack a year later, and the blocking of supply becomes harder, if not impossible.
There was another death, of course, on the High Court. Menzies died on the High Court.
Yes.
And that allowed the Whitlam government to put Lionel Murphy onto the High Court.
Indeed.
Which then enraged Garfield Barwick, which had some repercussions.
Tell me more about that.
Well, there were two deaths that year. One was Menzies, and the other one was Milliner. And one led to the completely outrageous behaviour of appointing that little prick. What was his name? He was from the French Polishers Union, of which there was one.
Albert Field.
Albert Field, thank you. But the other one was the appointment to the High Court. So there were two deaths, two accidents, and they both set things in train.
Yes.
Cleaver Bunting.
It's so nice having that in the green.
Cleaver was quite a decent guy. But anyway,
since we've got Anthony here, can I tell you about the story that he put me on?
Yes.
What's lovely about this room is this is sort of a crowdsourced book. I've realised the more I work on books...
A lot of acknowledgements at the back.
Yeah, so stuff is just better. The more people you ask about it and the more people you show it to. And I used to be really nervous about sharing my ideas or my pages with people until I've just realised that I am much smarter if I can draw on a whole lot of other people. I called up Anthony and I said I was working on a book on luck. And he said, well, you should talk about these two long-serving premiers. You should talk about Henry Bolte, who only got the job because Trevor Oldham, his predecessor, was flying over to London for the coronation of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II when the plane crashed and Trevor Oldham was killed. Bolte takes over and serves for nine on two decades, right? A little shy on two decades. So would otherwise, of course, in Melbourne, the Oldham Bridge that you were you're driving over, rather than the Bolte Bridge, would be Oldham who had executed the last person to be hung in Australia and so on. The other is Joe Bjelke Petersen's luck in Jack Pizzey's bad luck. Jack Pizzey, Joe's successor, has a heart attack. Bjelke Petersen steps into the fray and rules Queensland for the best part of three decades in that case.
There is, in fact, in the book, there's the heart attack
sub-theme,
but there is also the plane crash sub-theme. Mm. And you reminded me, I'd completely forgotten that gorgeous detail, that we got Franco for all those decades. Because the man who was supposed to have that job put in too many dress uniforms into the little plane that was carrying into Madrid, and it crashed. It crashed under the weight of his uniforms.
And I love the moment before takeoff where the pilot challenges the amount of luggage that he has packed, and he says, "No, I need these uniforms if I am to be a true Cadillo of Spain." Plane goes down. Franco becomes the ruler.
Spectacular. Okay, now look, this is a serious political exercise, and I'd like you all to understand that what we're talking about now can't really go outside this room because it is extremely arcane and powerful knowledge. I'm going to take Andrew through the steps and requirements for the successful election of, I'm just going to choose a sex at random, a man to the Australian Parliament. Now, firstly, it's not because, as I understand it, it's not because in Australia today it's easier if you're a man to get elected than if you're a woman. That's about equal these days?
It's close. Women at the ballot box suffer about a third of a percentage point penalty.
Still, in Australia. Yes. There are some countries in the world where I understand, rather strangely, it's an advantage to be a woman if you're going to for election.
The United States, it's about a one percentage point benefit.
Yes, yes. Still, they'll catch up with us in time. Okay. Now, your candidate, it's best that your candidate is handsome.
Indeed. Being handsome gives you somewhere between 1 and 2 percentage points extra votes. Part of being handsome is whether or not you smile and whether you're made up. So to some extent, beauty isn't just chance. But to a large extent, beauty is facial symmetry. And you can see this in experiments that the psychologists who work on beauty, and yes, there is such a subfield, they look, for example, at the response of newborn babies to faces. And they find newborn babies stare for longer at more symmetrical faces. Better-looking defendants are more likely to be acquitted in court. Better-looking workers, as you've said, David, earn more in the labour market. So it's not that surprising that if you're handed a piece of paper just before you go into the ballot box and it has on it a picture of the candidate, that information will somehow be salient in making the decision.
Now, what about the name beside that picture? Can you give us some indications of what kind of name is more electable?
Yes.
Not a Muslim name, for instance.
So again, names have been shown to matter in a range of other contexts. We are more likely to to move to places that start with the same letter as our name. Susie is more likely to live in Sydney than Melbourne, for example. Susie is also more likely to drive a Saturn than another model of car. So this sort of subconscious tendency of people to think that their name resonates means that people with more popular names do better at the ballot box.
Can I also interpose here? Susie is more likely, as I understand it, to give money to a candidate who is called Smith.
Indeed. And so there's this comes out of research done on the Bush-Gore election, which found that people with the last name starting with B were more likely to give to Bush, like people with the last name G more likely to give to Gore. And so all of this is, it's a function of people voting in context in which they don't have as much information as we'd like.
So we need an Anglo-Celtic name, a familiar Christian name. I noticed that David wasn't on the list in your book, but we'll take that to one side for the moment. But neither was Andrew.
Yes.
And we like our names to be blunt, short. We don't like Whissington Smith, hyphenated names. We like a good, plain name like Lee.
Yes, exactly.
Or Ma.
Yes.
These names are simpler, and so a name like Ma will, all else equal, garner about half a percentage point more than a name like Bassingthwaite, for example. Indeed, Palaszczuk. None of these things are perfectly predictive. There are still people who manage to make it through the system with complicated names, but all else equal, in a tight race, you'd rather have a simple name than a complicated one. Now, you might say that your name isn't pure luck, but my contention is for most people, when they're naming their children, they're not thinking about that child's electability. There's exceptions to this. So there was a candidate in 1998 who ran for the seat of Bennelong, and that candidate's name was John Howard Pissed the Family Court. I would suspect that Mr. Court probably chose his name with an eye to the fact that he was going to run against John Howard and Bennelong. But that's the exception rather than the rule.
Yes. So we've got the name straight. We've got beauty, sex, name. What about age? Particularly if you want to have a cabinet career, how old should you be as you go into Parliament?
So entry in your late 30s seems to be associated with a slightly higher probability of entering cabinet than entry in your 40s. You might well say, well, that's something you choose, but my observation of politics is that most people in politics jump on the bus the first time they see it stop. It's not to a large extent a matter of people saying, well, I have an opportunity to be in Parliament now, but I'm going to hold off for a decade when I'm more mature. Generally, when those opportunities come along, people grab them with both hands. And so, again, you might think about this as being some kind of luck.
And failure at the point of trying to jump on the bus the first time can actually have dramatically positive outcomes.
Positive outcomes for other people?
Or positive outcomes for
I'm trying
the
to
person.
Think which of my results you're thinking of.
Well, I'm thinking of Howard failing to get elected to the state seat.
Yes.
There's a whole range of these. Gillard didn't get a useful spot on the Senate ticket.
Yes, so the Victoria got up three Labor candidates in the 1993 election and the 1998 election, but not in the 1996 election.
So poor
in the 1996 election, she was Julie Gillard was number three. She would otherwise, of course, Senator Gillard would have been a cabinet minister, but it's difficult to imagine that Senator Gillard would have made the transition to the House of Representatives in time to be Prime Minister Gillard by 2010.
Oh, I don't know. If Bronwyn Bishop can come down from there. And there are oil paintings depicting this, of course. Anyway.
Did you want to do the state candidates? So one of my favourites is the Whitlam. Whitlam misses out.
Oh, yes.
So both Whitlam and Howard miss out on state seats. Whitlam misses out on the state seat of Sutherland in 1950. Howard misses out on the state seat of Des Moines in 1968. Not only do they miss out, but they miss out by a tiny amount, 420 votes in the case of Howard, 456 votes in the case of Whitlam, which is in both cases a matter of just 1 in 50 voters needing to change their votes for those people to end up in state politics. As Whitlam Whitlam also took a tilt at local politics, and as he said, I could have been Premier of New South Wales or Lord Mayor of the Sutherland Shire. Alas, the fates were against me.
Now, just briefly on the whole question of the donkey vote, one of the more disturbing aspects of your book is a finding that the tendency to vote down the ticket, the donkey tendency, is not in any way correlated to education.
Yes, so we've gotten much more educated over the course of the last generation.
But it hasn't helped.
But the donkey vote has stayed at about 1 in 100. And it seems to be... It's, of course, a little higher in electorates with higher shares of the voting population who don't have English as a first language. But it's also a function, I think, of apathy and frustration.
The young tend to be a bit donkey.
Yes, yes.
The young tend to be a bit donkey.
So you know, donkey voting goes down with all of the things that bring up political knowledge, but we know that formal education has gone up a lot in Australia, and donkey voting hasn't gone down as much as we'd like it to.
Now, in many ways, what we've been talking about so far in this exclusive, ladies and gentlemen, this exclusive analysis of politics, which is not to go beyond this room, are a number of things which are in some ways controllable. But let's get to the uncontrollable factors of the weather on election day. What is the impact of the weather on election day?
So this surprised me. What I had been expecting to find was a strong partisan bias. I'd have been expecting that, as has been found in some US studies, when it rains, the poor can't get to the polls and the Labor Party does worse.
Yeah.
But I didn't find that, David. I found instead a pattern which seems to be a pattern which it affects the incumbent, regardless of which party is in power. If you're a party in power hoping to be re-elected, you want it to be rainy and cool on election day. If you're an insurgent and you want to overturn the government, you want it to be hot and dry. Think sort of fierce desert conditions. In the gentle cool of the rainforest, people are happy to keep the leaders they have. In the fierce, angry heat of the dry desert, people turf them out and go for the other team. Again, effects which are not trivial. We're talking about a percentage point either way, and this is often the difference between victory and defeat.
Now, lately, sadly, there have been reports, especially on the east coast of Australia, of really terrifying shark attacks.
Mm.
If these were to continue at this rate into next year, the election year, what would the impact of shark attacks be on the chances of the Abbott government being re-elected?
So this research comes from a Princeton...
I thought I was joking. Yeah.
Some Princeton researchers who looked at the shark attacks that inspired the film Jaws. These are the brutal attacks that occur off the coast of New Jersey, including the taking of by sharks of young boys swimming. And the researchers then looked at the vote for Woodrow Wilson, then the Democratic incumbent in the 1916 presidential elections. Remember, the American summer is mid-year, American elections in November. They estimated that Wilson's vote is down around 10 percentage points in the shark-affected counties of New Jersey compared to those that are not shark-affected. And they put it down to people just wanting to blame someone for being frustrated. One of my co-authors, Paul Burke, has pulled out a lovely old quote about how the Mayan kings would often fear being overthrown when the harvests had been bad, and similarly Egyptian rulers in times of when there wasn't enough flooding of the canals would often fear that they would be overthrown. So people see acts of God but look for someone on earth to blame.
You don't think, though, and look, you know, call me a devil's advocate here, You don't think, do you, that the shark attacks in New Jersey and Woodrow Wilson's vote going down might not have just been a coincidence?
It's entirely possible. So I did... you've said this is an exclusive, so let me give you some stuff that's not in the book. I did look at the re-election rate of premiers across Australia as a function of the number of shark attacks. I contacted the International Shark Attack Database, which, as you know, is at the University of Florida. They sent me a file of all of the shark attacks, the shark fatalities in the last 120 years. I matched them up to Australian state elections, looking at the 3-month window, 6-month window, 9-month window. There was a little bit there, but I just wasn't confident enough you look at the Coogee shark attacks of 1922 in the 1922 state election, you know. But I couldn't hang my hat on it, so I just told my readers the New Jersey story and figured if they were wise enough to come to a book launch, they'd hear the rest.
Right. Okay. There are disturbing facts in this book, ladies and gentlemen. One of the disturbing facts is that this man has the time to do all this work when he's representing a seat in the House of Representatives. But I'm not going to be critical because I'm completely delighted by this book. But there are disturbing things like this. He looks at the impact on the stock exchange of the deaths of political leaders and discovers harrowing facts like this. When Harold Holt drowned, the Australian share market went up. I mean, how heartless are we?
So what is striking about this is that the share market doesn't seem to care two hoots who is Prime Minister. Now, there may be that the share market is just one indicator of economic outcomes. Certainly there are things that the economic outcomes that governments affect which go well beyond stocks. But if that's your narrow measure, and what's nice about it is we can compare results just before and after a leadership challenge, or on the Friday before an election and the Monday after it, I don't see any significant pattern which suggests to me that the markets are jumping around in response to who's leading the country. Yeah. You know, at one level this is a little disturbing. I like to think the politics matters a lot. On the other, perhaps there is a sense that the share markets, you know, in most cases have anticipated the change that's going to happen. So maybe none of these events are massive surprises to them.
Mm. Still heartless. The lack of sentiment, the lack of sentimentality in the stock exchanges of the world is something that troubles me profoundly. And I don't know what we're going to do about it. There's another troubling discovery in this book, and I think I might have heard about this, but I've always flinched from reading it, but because I had serious responsibilities tonight, I did read it, which is that a bunch of monkeys are better at predicting the future than a group of media pundits. That's surely a mistake of some kind.
Yeah, so fortunately, David, you've never appeared on programs such as Meet the Press and Insiders, but I did, just for fun... Well, you have, that's right. I did just for fun look...
I'm always overshadowed by Jared. People don't even know I'm there. But go on.
You should take him on one day when you disagree with him.
Better let them hang themselves.
It turns out that if you look at the falsifiable predictions that are made by pundits, that they don't turn out to do very well. There's two interesting things about this. The first is that media pundits make surprisingly few falsifiable predictions. That is, generally they'll say, well, I think the Canning by-election will be won by Tony Abbott, but you never know what could happen. But occasionally they make falsifiable predictions, and we find that only about two-thirds of those falsifiable predictions come true. An analysis that was done by Nate Silver, looking at another show, the McLaurin Report, found that that actually they were shooting 50-50 in that show. Work by Philip Tetlock, which used anonymous predictions from a large swath of
of a huge expert number pundits. Of anonymous predictions.
Yes, around 30,000 predictions from around 500 pundits. Finds that they do no better than what one reviewer of Tetlock's book called dart-throwing monkeys. That is, that if you want to know what's going to happen, don't ask a pundit. But indeed, the pundits that do worse are those that Tetlock describes as being hedgehogs, those with a single big idea. Those who do better are what he calls foxes. This is from the old Isaiah Berlin essay. Who can accommodate multiple perspectives, new facts, new ideas, see the world as a pastiche of evidence rather than through a single grand theory. Trouble is, hedgehogs are much more appealing to watch on TV because they have a grand theory of the world. Foxes are less interesting because they're on the one hand and the other hand. Problem is, foxes are more likely to be right, hedgehogs are more likely to be wrong.
But, and this I thought was the interesting conclusion of this argument in your book, was you can be a hedgehog wrong the entire time and have a big career as a pundit if you're entertaining.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, now that's encouraging in its own way. At the back of this book,
you're a fox, though, aren't you, David?
Hey, look, I'm a hedgehog with some fox qualities, is what I would say. Jared Henderson, by the way, is really terrific on the stupidities of press predictions. It's a thing he does every year, an absolutely wonderful, devastating collection of ridiculous predictions, and I think it's a valuable thing. At the back of this book, you acknowledge the luckiest thing that happened in your life was finding your wife. That is the luckiest thing that happens in anybody's life, isn't it? Finding their partner.
It is. I think I sort of have it two ways in that acknowledgement section. It starts off by saying the luckiest thing is the circumstances of my birth, and my parents, Barbara and Michael, are here this evening, which is fortunate.
Oh, I'd have been much tougher if I'd known that.
Yeah. And then I think I try and have a bit each way by also saying that I was incredibly fortunate to meet my wife. But both of those kind of speak to the fact that I'm acutely aware that I have been extremely lucky. And I hate the sort of Ayn Rand view of the world, that everything is hard work, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You've got to acknowledge good luck when it's happened to you, because that, I think, gives you a gentler, more rounded view of the world and your place in it.
And you conclude, indeed, that luck is rather left... acknowledging luck is rather left-wing.
So there is this sort of Rorschach test that you can do. If you ask people, do you believe that chance plays a role in life? If the person you're speaking to immediately says yes, it's more likely you're speaking to a left-winger than a right-winger. Now, this wasn't completely true in my interviews. I interviewed Mark Latham, who thought that luck played very little part in his own career, despite having won a leadership ballot when he persuaded one of his colleagues to call a footballer on the morning of the vote, and that footballer, Robert Stone, persuaded him to change his vote. Latham said, I would have won it. And then on the right side, John Howard, who was a very generous interviewee, gave me an hour of his time, dived into the theory with relish, gave me a whole host of examples, was very reflective in particular about the role of early failure and later success, which you see in both Menzies' career and in Howard's career, both dumped by their party early on, then comes back. It's an issue that Howard reflects on in his biography of Menzies, and again talked about in the interview that I did with him. So Latham and Howard, exception that proves the rule, in general progressives tend to prefer, believe that luck matters. And I've got some survey evidence in there too, if you want that.
You quote in the book that wonderful remark of F. Scott Fitzgerald's, that there are no second acts in American lives. And I wonder whether Australian politics now has reached a spot where there are no second acts in political lives, but you only get one chance. And the careers of men like Menzies and indeed Beazley will not happen again. It's all one shot now. You fail, that's it, over.
I'm very nervous about this, David, and it is one of the things that drove me to write the book. I mean, you asked before why, you know, effectively you said, why are you dilly-dallying around writing books rather than supporting your constituents? But
that's rather overstating it.
But that's certainly, it's a reasonable question that someone might ask. And part of the answer is that while luck can be fun, I believe it's a topic serious people should care about. That if you understand the role of luck in life, you understand why we've got a healthcare system, a social safety net, and unemployment benefits. But if you understand the role of luck too, you can understand how we as a society can benefit from early failure. There's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who took as the number plate for his car the name of his first failed company. And in Silicon Valley, mottos like fail fast and fail smart are all the rage. We need that notion in politics too. The idea that people do learn from early failure. It's not a coincidence that our two longest serving prime ministers had early failure in their career. And benefiting from the lessons of failure is ultimately good for us as a country.
Wonderful. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terrific.
David.